Welcome to Research Integrity Matters, the podcast where Gauri and Marino discuss research integrity and its importance to research quality with academic experts from a multidisciplinary perspective. Research Integrity Matters is co-initiated and sponsored by the Netherlands Research Integrity Network, and all our episodes can be found on nrin.nl. That's nrin.nl. My name is Gauri, and I'm here together with Marino.
Hi.
And you're listening to the fifth episode of Research Integrity Matters. Today, we have two guests on our podcast. Welcome to Lynn and Sandra. We are joined by them from different parts of the world. Lynn, who's based in Cape Town, Sandra in Amsterdam. And we are very honored to speak with them about the recent Cape Town statement on fostering research integrity through fairness and equity. A statement which Sandra and myself have co-authored. This is a statement that advocates for fair practice from conception to implementation of research and provides about a number of recommendations aimed at different types of stakeholders. We're also interested in discussing with Sandra the Bridge guidelines, which she will tell us a little bit more later on in the podcast today. We're looking forward to this podcast. So without any further ado, let's get started with a bit of an introduction of who Lynn and Sandra are. So Professor Lynn Horn is currently the director of the Office of Research Integrity at the University of Cape Town and at the Center for Applied Ethics at Stellenbosch University. Lynn is a medical doctor with a PhD in bioethics. She's worked as a clinician in the public health sector before transitioning to academic work. And as part of her academic work, she teaches research ethics, bioethics, and promotes and facilitates the responsible conduct of research across the entire university. Lynn is also involved in investigations of allegations of breaches in research ethics and integrity. Dr. Sandra Alba is an epidemiologist at the Royal Tropical Institute in the Netherlands with a long-standing background in medical statistics and epidemiology. She has about 15 years of experience in the application of these methods to evaluate global health programs. She also has ample experience in designing studies, developing data collection tools, data management and analysis of data, as well as formulating public policy recommendations. Very recently, she's published the Bridge Guidelines, which focuses on good epidemiological practice, looking at a global health epidemiology. We will be discussing the Cape Town Statement as well as the Bridge Guidelines today. So to get us started, can each of you tell us a little bit more about the specific focus of your current research? Maybe I'll invite Lynn to start.
Thanks, Gauri. Do you want me to talk about the Cape Town Statement? Or
you can give us a more of a general overview of your day-to-day research focus, and then we'll dive into the Cape Town Statement later.
All right. So I am, in fact, get very little time to do research. I'm the director of the Office of Research Integrity, and I have a very big management portfolio, which, you know, is not so great, really. But I try my best, and one of the interests that I've always had has been issues around social justice. And I think that's my background. I actually worked as a medical practitioner in South Africa, often in very resource-limited settings for about 20 years before I transitioned slowly into a more academic environment, and particularly working in the field of research ethics. So, and I think a lot of those experiences that I had while working as a doctor, I even worked as a TB medical officer for quite a long time in some of the very much poorer areas in Cape Town. And I guess it's those kinds of experience and the understanding of how important research, particularly health research, is, and some of the fairness and inequity gaps that play out in the research, in the research arena, that kind of led me in this direction of developing with a whole lot of people developing the Cape Town Statement. So at the moment, I'm not really getting all that much opportunity to do research, but I'm hoping that that will change within the next year. Now that the statement is finally published and it'll be a chance to to, you know, to relook at. And public health research ethics has always been my main interest. It's what I did my PhD in, rather late in the day for an academic. I won't tell you what age I was when I got my PhD, but it was, you know, public health ethics and the research that underpins public health is what I'm particularly interested in. So that's me.
Thank you. Thanks, Lynn. Sandra?
I'm you've already introduced me, but yeah, maybe to say a little bit more about it. I would say a global health epidemiologist. So my work focuses on access to health, health systems strengthening, and health equity. I would say I'm a data cruncher, but at the same time, I also realize that we can only begin to understand, you know, the big complex problems that affect the health of people worldwide if we join forces with other disciplines. So the importance of multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary approaches, of course, anthropology, political sciences, all of the, you know, those type of disciplines, but then also computing and AI, mathematical modeling. I think all of that we need to look at globally to really understand the complexity of issues and how to address them. I spent actually 2 years in rural Tanzania for my PhD. I did a PhD in it was really epidemiology, epidemiological methods, epidemiology. I was studying access to malaria treatment, and that experience in Tanzania really was a very formative experience that opened my eyes to a lot of issues that we encounter while trying to conduct epidemiological studies in North-South partnerships. So that North-South partnerships is a way to say partnerships between institutes in high-income countries and institutes in middle-income countries. And that's made me reflect a lot over the course of my career. And now at KIT, I work at the Royal Tropical Institute and still work a lot in North-South partnerships, and also teach quite a lot. I teach epidemiology and statistics in our master's in public health. And this is really, yeah, a platform where we see so many students coming from all over the world. And this teaching epidemiology to these to such a varied crowd of students also always makes us realize and makes us reflect a lot about what it means to work in partnerships and in practice. So I think, yeah, that's a bit how I got into this topic, realizing that, yeah, we need good epidemiological methods for good studies, but also we need to be careful in the way that we conduct our studies so that we really reach good, what does good science mean when we're in partnerships? It also means working in a certain way, working with fair and equitable partnerships.
I was just about to ask that, like, you call yourself a data cruncher, and somehow you did end up in how to do good science, improve science practices, but that you realized over time that this is very important. Is that the summary of what I'm hearing?
Yeah, for sure. It's, you realize, I guess in the beginning, you know, at least from my perspective, I always studied, you know, very technical topics, medical statistics and epidemiology. And but as soon as I was then thrown into a real life study, I realized that, yeah, to really understand, you know, the issues and to really address the problems, then actually I need a lot more than I was taught. And I also realized that the limits actually of, you know, the way that we teach and we prepare a workforce, we're not always so prepared to actually deal with the problems that we see in real life. And this is actually now changing, because indeed research integrity is playing an important role in preparing the scientific workforce, so to speak. And I think that's, of course, for the better.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, my introduction was I was a student during the time that Diederik Stapel was the dean of my school. And then I saw his entire downfall. So for me, that was the big, like, okay, research needs to be done properly. Otherwise, we get this. Which is a super extreme example, of course. So on the topics, because I was noticing that Lynn was very eager to talk about the Cape Town Statement, and I'm very happy that you're eager to talk about it, because I want to, well, our listeners would probably want to hear more about it. Just for our listeners, we'll put the Cape Town Statement in the show notes so you can read the entire statement. But first, of course, I would love for Lynn to talk about what the inspiration was for the Cape Town Statement, and why you and your co-authors felt the need to publish this. So can you talk a bit more about that?
Okay, so certainly, I think my background, my fusion between working as an ethicist in clinical trials was definitely one of the things that underpinned, which started to get my head rolling around issues of equity and fairness. I've also have worked or have acted, not rather than worked, as a bioethicist or an ethics advisor for some European EDCTP-funded clinical trials, where I actually went, to sites in places like Mozambique and Malawi and places like that. And I worked as an ethicist for quite a long time with the Desmond Tutu TB Foundation at Stellenbosch University that did big community-based cluster randomized trials in HIV and TB. And so this was sort of, what started to get me interested in North-South and all high-income, low-income collaborations. And I think it's important to say that most of those collaborations are really good and that their intentions are always good. I don't think that there are ever malintentions at the start of these kinds of collaborations. But there certainly are things that go, power differentials that aren't properly recognized, and things that can go wrong within or be problematic within these collaborations. And I think as a ethicist, sort of sitting somewhat on the side and observing, you really do start to realize where some of the problems and the gaps are. And then for my own institution, I undertook to do the research fairness initiative evaluation for my institution. I don't know if you know about it, but I have to give credit to Professor Carl Isselmaden from the Council on Health Research and Development, who based in Geneva, because he really got me thinking around this and tackling a very big project, which was to do this internal evaluation at my own institution. And that was the forerunner for the proposal that we made to the World Conference on Research Integrity to actually come up with the statement and to realize that unfairness and inequity and lack of diversity is a research integrity issue. And there's been a lot of talking around, at that. It's not we weren't new at all, but and Sandra's bridge guidelines came before the Cape Town statement. But it's making that link, I think, between research integrity and fairness and equity that is so important. And they really in the article that was published in Nature, it really, if you read that article, it really is clear all the areas where inequity can impact on research integrity. So so that was the initial journey in putting a proposal and then gathering many interested people that really wanted to be involved in this journey, developing a pre-conference paper and then having multiple sessions at the conference where we discussed this, where Gauri and Sandra were present. And eventually pulling it together into a statement, so with recommendations. So that's the background to the Cape Town statement.
So Lynn, if I can just jump in here, I think in a way we're sort of preaching to the choir with Sandra Marino, yourself clearly, and me about the link. Which may seem very explicit to some of us working on research integrity, issues of equity and diversity and its impact on research quality. But often I encounter situations where the larger research community don't see this as a direct and explicit link. There are often discussions that these are more social justice issues rather than issues that directly impact research integrity and research quality. So can you crystallize for our listeners, what is this relationship between diversity, equity, and research fairness and its impact on research integrity?
I mean, I think there are many areas you know, where it does impact. And the first one is at the beginning of the whole process, is the research agenda and priority setting. And so what happens often actually is that that research agenda is set primarily by the high-income country person who is responding to a high-income country funder grant call, and has already got an idea together and developed a protocol and now needs to work with a collaborator in a lower-income country, or maybe wants to do the research. But the agenda is often quite formed already by time the collaborators get brought on board. So that can mean that not always the exact right questions get answered, or they get pushed to one side. Maybe there's funding issues, or the funding is always tight. Further down the line, in terms of doing secondary data analysis, so often the data gets uploaded onto a server that's sitting at a university in Northern Europe, and there's been research to show that the World Health Organization Global Forum on Bioethics really discussed this and showed that there was research to show that the collaborators in the LMIC countries, for example, in Africa, usually don't access that data. There seems to be a barrier to access it for secondary analysis and to maybe answer some. So it's data that they've collected, and you hear this from LMIC researchers, we are just glorified data collectors, because we collect the data, it gets taken, it gets uploaded somewhere, it's difficult to access, and those secondary analyses don't ever get done, or otherwise the LMIC researcher is working in a very resource-constrained environment where he's doing all sorts, doesn't have the, often teaching and doing all sorts of things, and may not have the resources or the research systems that are actually supporting him to do this kind of, him or her to do this additional research. So that's one area. There's also funders push for data to be released as quickly as possible. I mean, this is, and sure, if it's publicly funded, sure, it should be. But sometimes it means that LMIC researcher doesn't actually get access to do some of the stuff on that data, whereas a very well-resourced person sitting, or group or team sitting, in a northern hemisphere country that wasn't even involved in the original project, then, can do those sort of secondary data crunching and data analysis. So that's one of the things. Obviously, authorship. I mean, if one reads the Nature article, there's so much evidence and much more than what we were able to reflect in that article, LMIC authors don't land up on papers. The data can be collected from their country, but they're often, or they're right in the middle of the authorship line. So their contribution is not adequately acknowledged. Another place, it's also the issue of whose voice do you actually listen to? And if you are, and this is where the diversity and inclusivity thing comes in, which was part of our statement. Do certain voices hold much more weight than others? And I think that this can sometimes be the case in collaborations, so that there isn't the adequate acknowledgement. Not always, but sometimes. And it can be quite inadvertent, But, I think I've said a whole lot there.
I thought it was very interesting, so that's no problem there at all. I was just wondering, basically the similar question to Sandra, because you worked on the bridge statement, so again, for you, what inspired you to draft it? What needs did you want to address with the statement?
Yeah, Yeah, interestingly, similarly to Lynn, it also kind of started with clinical trials. I worked as a statistician in a contract research organization in Switzerland as a clinical trial statistician. There I got, I learned about good clinical practice and realized actually how much there was to learn for epidemiologists from that way of working. And so that got me a bit into the path of good epidemiological practice and, you know, standards for epidemiological practice. But indeed, soon and quickly, because of my background in global health and because of teaching also epidemiology to students from all over the world, I soon realized, we cannot do research integrity without taking into account research fairness. If we're looking at research conducted in global health, these two things need to be married in some way. And I think conceptually, the approach we took with the Bridge guidelines was, guidelines for good epidemiological practice are really embedded in the tradition of research integrity. And what we thought at the time was like, okay, we need integrity and fairness. So the approach we took was to marry together integrity and fairness and saying, these are two important dimensions that need to guide our practice. We need to do it with integrity and fairness. And this was a bit of a precursor to the Cape Town statement because it really came chronologically before. But what I've really enjoyed seeing and been inspired with the Cape Town statement is Lynn's approach, which goes a step further and says, no, it's not that we have integrity on one side and fairness on the other. It's like we will not have integrity without fairness. So it's a bit conceptually a different way of looking at it. But very, very inspiring, because basically we're saying you do not have good research if you do not have fair research. And really seeing fairness as an element of, you know, good science. How do we get good science? Well, we only have good science if we have a fair process, because this is how we will get the right research question, as Lynn mentioned. This is how we will have contextualized tools, because we have the tools that are contextualized to the right setting. This is how we will have research outputs that are credible and trusted. And this is how we will have impact. We will have impactful science, because local decision makers will act upon studies that are locally relevant and conducted locally. So it's like a different approach, which I think, and by now, you know, I'm sold. I see it actually that way. And I think it's a nice evolution to then see it, you know, we need to rethink integrity, at least in global health partnerships, to have that that kind of view. And actually, we recently conducted a study based on the Bridge guidelines, and this really emerged. How it's not a dichotomy of fairness and integrity. No, it's really together. It was a mixed methods study, and so there was a quantitative component, but also some qualitative interviews. And really, from the qualitative interviews, we saw how these two things are, integrity and fairness, are really part and parcel of the same problem of good science. Because helicopter research, for example, is really a topic. It's when, you know, researchers from the global north, from a high-income country, are catapulted in a setting that they don't know well for just a few weeks to, you know, collect some data, go back home and write up their study. It's a big problem, this helicopter research phenomenon. And it's traditionally looked at a problem from a fairness point of view. It's not fair that, you know, because you have a more wealthy, you come from a wealthier university, you have more means, that you come and you know, it's an extractive process of grabbing data, writing a publication, and, you know, publishing, collecting data and then publishing. It's extractive, so it's unfair. But actually, when we did our study and we did these interviews, we also saw this is also from an integrity perspective really problematic, because these are often junior students, younger. These are often students, so junior researchers who come. They're not sufficiently supervised. So it's research that's done in a hurry, not well thought through. So it's also integrity at the same time. So these two things are not separate. And this was really a clear realization during our study. And there's a few more examples where you see, actually, if we want good science, because we need to have a holistic kind of understanding of integrity.
Thanks. Actually, that prompts me to ask a very quick question, if I may. I'm I mean, I've obviously, as I've stated, also co-authored the Cape Town Statement, was part of the process at the World Conferences in Cape Town, which is now feels like a long time ago, although it was, if I'm not wrong, a year ago that it was held in 2022. I mean, we talk a lot about this being an issue of the global North and South, which it really is pronounced there. But I also wonder, what are your thoughts, you know, at a more on a microcosm? So at the institutional level, within each and every one of the institutions that we work in, I think there has been quite a lot of research. For example, our first speaker on the podcast, Cassidy Sugimoto, who does a lot of research looking at how authors, even within different institutions, are delegated based on the ethnicity, based on their career stage, face actually exactly these issues that are addressed in the Cape Town Statement and to a certain degree also in the bridge guidelines. How do you perceive that on a more local level, even within the global North, for example, at our own institutional level? Do you feel that the issues that are addressed in the Cape Town Statement and the bridge guidelines are also relevant to every researcher's institutional practices, regardless of whether they are from the global North or South?
Yeah, I'm thinking, actually. It's a difficult one. I'm not sure exactly. I mean, for sure, there's these different determinants, right? There's determinants at individual level. There's determinants at institutional levels, and then there's these, like, you know, bigger determinants that have more to do with the macro level, the funding, how funding is organized, and also publication and all of that. So for sure, there's like these determinants at different levels that can affect both integrity and fairness. And actually, what we've noticed in the study that we recently conducted is that in fact the determinants are the same ones. The determinants that create questionable research practices, or that create unfair research practices, are very similar. And it's got to do with the very competitive environment that we work in science, that, you know, makes us sometimes even behave against our you know, better judgment. Because we're constantly competing for all sorts of research resources, and then competing against each other for publications. And I think, yeah, you see that at every level. You see it indeed at institutional level and between institutes. So whatever guidelines can address that between institutes, so from, you know, if we look at it from global North and global South, should also look at it between institutes in the same country, but also then between colleagues in the same institute. It's about, you know, working indeed with integrity. But I don't know, I guess I'm not answering it very specifically, but I hope it helps.
Lynn, I'm curious to hear your view on this.
Well, you know, I come from a particular context, which is South Africa, with its history, long history of colonialism and apartheid, and institutions that, especially, you know, the institutions we talk about in our country about historically disadvantaged institutions, and then the historically advantaged and white institutions at which I have worked. And so this is a huge issue, and it's increasingly the push to recognize, you know, the disadvantage that researchers working within these institutions that come from historically disadvantaged backgrounds and are still being seen in particular lights. Obviously, things are changing, and we really at my institution, it's a huge push for what we call transformation and change. But so I guess from, you know, from our particular context, it's kind of quite different in a way. But I think I think the fact that if you choose your research team of people that all look just like you, you're gonna come up with answers that are quite blinkered, you know, and by bringing other people's perspectives, into play, you just get a whole different idea about you know, what's important and hopefully people that can call out biases in research results, the way they've been interpreted in that, because of that diversity in research teams. If we really do tackle that in the way that I hope that it will be, you know, and that funders will actually have diversity stipulations and recognize that geographic, you know, that it's not just, you know, racial or whatever, it's cultural and ethnicity, and all of that can bring a richness to a problem that one particular view might not be able to see. So, yeah,
indeed. Great. Thank you. I mean, I myself, you know, I am of an ethnic background. I had the privilege of, you know, being born and raised in what would be described as a higher middle income country. I work in a higher middle income country, but I obviously, you know, fall in the group of intersectionality as an ethnic female working in STEM research. And I have to say that I see some of these issues mirrored in colleagues like me. So the point that I guess I was trying to understand here is that I think that these recommendations should also be looked at and taken seriously within each and every one of our institutions, that our research need to reflect the societies that we live in, and otherwise we might not be adequately reflecting the knowledge base that is representative of our societies.
Yeah, there's the one saying, no research about us without us, and I think that that applies so often. I think it's a good one to keep in mind whenever you're looking at, you know, certain research.
I was, so for the sake of time, because we almost have to finish already, unfortunately. So I was wondering, what would you like to see in the near future for the CTS and Bridge? So basically, very practically, my question is, if you have the ultimate power to change something that is in your statements, what would you change tomorrow? And you can't say the entire statement needs to be implemented, obviously. So you have to prioritize now.
Yeah, I think I might answer this question by not answering the question, actually, which is, I think when we wrote the Bridge guidelines, you know, it was a wish list. In a way, you know, it was a group of stakeholders that were convened through a Delphi consultation process. And from the beginning, we were all looking at this as epidemiologists, as researchers, thinking, this is like the perfect study that no one can implement. And we were all looking at each other saying, I have never done a study that complies all of this. And also thinking, it's not even possible. So and so the way we embarked on this, it was a process with everyone. And then we were also kind of at some point feeling a bit uncomfortable. It's like, do we really want to put this out and uphold? You know, is this impossible to achieve? Do we want to be really, you know, advocating that people should uphold this type of behavior that we ourselves cannot uphold? And then this kind of then also in the end, we thought, well, let's take that into the paper and into the guidelines. So in the end, the guidelines are not, although we say they're a checklist, we actually want them to be a checklist of things that you should think about. And not necessarily a checklist of things that you should do, but like everything. So in the end, the Bridge guidelines really reflect the conduct of an epidemiological study chronologically, although it's a bit forced because we know that some things are a bit iterative. You know, you collect data, then you analyze, and then you collect some more. So we force a type of chronological order that doesn't exist. But in the checklist, these are all things that we ideally want people to think about. And, you know, maybe you decide to not do a certain thing, not to fulfill a certain criteria, but it's something that you've discussed in your team. It's something that you do consciously that that's not possible. For example, open data sharing. Of course, you know, ideally, yes, but there may be reasons why you don't do it. Also, well, one that we struggle with a lot, actually, at the moment with at KIT is authorship. We work in some contexts that are very difficult at the moment, like Afghanistan. The political situation is very complex. We work on sensitive issues. Well, in Afghanistan, also just, you know, women's rights is a difficult issue. And we have certain colleagues who, in the current climate, do not want to put themselves out there as being authors of certain publications because it may work against them. So then we have publications on Afghanistan with very few Afghan researchers, but this was really their choice. And then it's a decision that we take, like, okay, we will still go ahead with this publication. And this has been discussed with the team with few Afghan authors because few actually wanted that. So I think working with these guidelines and trying to implement them, I think we've become a little bit more nuanced about what it means to follow guidelines. And for us, following guidelines means, thinking about it. And it's not about checking boxes, but it's about, it's about the process of reflecting and thinking and trying your best. It's about the integrity, I think, is about the intentions and having the right intentions rather than checking boxes. So, yeah, a bit of a long-winded answer to your question. That's not really an answer, but hopefully still is a bit of an answer.
No, I think if I summarize what your dream is that that the statement makes people reflect on a daily basis on research choices, but not that it might be the gold standard, but we know we will never achieve the gold standard, but at least if it forces people to critically rethink their choices, it's done its job.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Perfect. Lynn, what is your dream for the Cape Town statement? And what would you change tomorrow?
Well, our statement directly addresses a number of stakeholders. And I would really like, if those stakeholders, if over a period of time there was real traction in terms of for instance, funders. I mean, funders can play a big role in stopping some kinds of helicopter research. Publishers, open science in terms of, we haven't spoken about open science here, but that's a big issue. And in terms of page costs and access to what page costs that are often absolutely prohibitive for LMIC researchers. They simply cannot publish in journals that charge the kinds of page costs that many gold standard open access journals charge. And although there is definitely a movement in the right direction there, I'm hoping that the statement would help to gain impetus and to make things move along a little bit quicker. And yeah, so that would be, and I know there's not going to be radical change immediately, but I think that it will gain traction over a period of time. And it is something that will make people, really think about things a little bit more carefully. The statement says there are often power differentials that go undisclosed in collaborations. Well, what about our collaboration? What are the power differentials that are perhaps having a negative? What are the courageous conversations that we need to have within that collaboration? And just to think about it. So that would be my wish.
Cool. Indeed, $5,000 or $10,000 for a one article in a journal is perhaps even in our context excessive, let alone in LMIC context, definitely. And I also hear in your proposal, Lynn, that you would like people to be inspired, like I heard Sandra say in a similar way. So there is overlap there. That's really nice to hear. That was actually today's podcast. So I'm going to close off by saying that this was Research Integrity Matters with Lynn Horn and Sandra Alba, hosted by Gauri and Marino and produced by Maarten van Woerkom. We thank Netherlands Research Integrity Network for co-initiating and sponsoring this podcast series. You can find all the relevant links to the papers mentioned, to the Cape Town Statement and the Bridge Statement in the show notes. And you can follow Research Integrity Matters in your favorite podcast app like Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcast. And with respect to Apple Podcasts, we'd like to ask you to leave a review, and that will help others to discover this podcast as well. We would love to answer your questions, so if you have questions for us, then you can find our email address or Twitter accounts in the show notes as well. That's it for this time. Thank you for listening, and until the next episode.